Good evening and welcome to Amandla here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Amandla is 1 hour of African current affairs brought to you today by Doug and myself, Gwen, but principally really Doug. So Doug, what's lined up?
Well, exciting news from the Guardian, a special report on Chagos Islands. Chagos Islands, those little remote islands in the center of the Indian Ocean that are supposed to belong to Mauritius, but were taken over by Britain and sold to the United States. And the people who inhabited those islands were shipped out wholesale in 1968. Family, lock, stock, and barrel, dogs were killed. It was very reminiscent of colonial Northern Canada. Mm-hmm. And the people have done years and years of struggle and are now going home. They instead of just talking about it and going for heritage visits that the British allow them or the Americans allow them, they took a trip with their lawyer up to the home island of several of them, and they declared themselves home on their land. So that's coming from The Guardian. And I will also after that talk to people about Omicron experience that we've learned from South Africa. Stay tuned though to the Chagos Island. It's special. It's wonderful.
This is The Guardian.
Today, a five-day boat journey to the Chagos Islands and a 50-year struggle for justice for the people of Britain's last colony in Africa. Hello?
Hi there, it's Philippe Sands here with Bruno.
Hello, Philippe, how are you?
Very well, very well. I'm with Bruno, we're in his bathroom, which we're using as a studio.
Okay. The line is good, given everything. Given, you know, bathroom on a boat in the Indian Ocean, it's pretty good. Oh, no, you've just cut out. Philippe Sands is an author and international lawyer. Last week, he left the Seychelles, a country off the coast of East Africa, aboard a yacht carrying scientists, journalists, and five Chagos Islanders, making an unauthorised trip home.
Let's turn to Mauritius. The government there is sending a boat to the disputed Chagos Islands in the Indian Ocean. Now, the boat, which is to conduct scientific research, is
We spoke to Philippe with a little help from Guardian video journalist Bruno Rinvalukri while they were still on the way.
We're 2 days out of Seychelles. We're exactly halfway. It's 1,000 miles. The weather's been mixed, a few hours pretty choppy, then calm, and we expect to arrive, make land in 2 days' time.
Olivier Bancou was from Peros Banos, one of the islands that makes up the Chagos archipelago.
On the boat, we are all excited to see our birthplace. By tomorrow, midday, we will be able to see Peros Banos, one of the main islands where I myself was born.
For the Mauritian government, whose case Philippe is pursuing, it's an opportunity to stake its claim to islands it says was stolen from it by the British government decades ago. For Olivier and the other Chagosians, it's a chance to see home again.
For them, it's a very important visit because it's the first time they've gone back without being escorted by the British, shall we say.
This is the story of a colonial crime, one that took place in the dying days of the British Empire, out of the view of the British public, and the decades of struggle by survivors to force the UK to rectify it. From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, the long road home for the people of the Chagos Islands, and why the British government is defying international rulings to stand in their way. Olivier was just 4 years old when his family were removed from their homes. Years later, his sister would write this song about their longing for everything they'd lost.
It's my sister who sings that song. I feel very sad because all that she told in that song, it's a reality. She left Chagos at the age of 13. Talk about the injustice. How could we now left our buried there without any flowers on the grave? Let me tell you, my great-great-grandfather was born in Paris. My great-grandfather was born in Salomo. My grandmother, mother's side, born in Peros Banos. My mom born in Peros Banos. Me also, I was born. That means that we have more than five generations been living in Chagos for many years.
Philippe, you're representing the Mauritian government in their effort to try to reclaim these islands. What's the background here? Tell me about the Chagos Islands and the people who live there.
It was apparently discovered by Portuguese mariners in the 16th century. It then became a Dutch colony and then a French colony. But the workers, so to speak, they had been brought in as enslaved people. They arrived in quite significant numbers, brought in from Mozambique, largely, and they worked on these coconut plantations, copra plantations. And in 1814, the French handed it over to the British. By the time the mid-1960s arrived, they've been there for well over 150 years. I mean, six, seven, eight generations.
And how did families like Olivier's come to be snatched from their homes?
So from 1814 until 1968, Mauritius was a British colony. Part of that colony was called the Chagos Archipelago. And in 1965, as independence for Mauritius came into sight, the British and the Americans cut a secret deal to give one of the 58 islands, called Diego Garcia, to the Americans as a military base. And in that context, the British decided that in order to do that, they would have to dismember Chagos from Mauritius. And in order to do that legally, they believed, if they could argue at the UN that there was no permanent population, they would be able to do it. So they proceeded to remove the entire population, not just from Diego Garcia, but from every other island. That started happening in about 1968. By 1973, 5 years after Mauritian independence, the entire population of about 2,000 Chagossians had been removed.
How do you physically relocate 2,000 people, many of whom I'm sure would have been very unwilling to leave their homes?
You do it in appalling ways, lots of different ways.
When my mom go to the dispensary in Peros Banos to have treatment for my sister.
Olivier's baby sister, still just a toddler, had been seriously injured in a collision with a cart.
The nurse told my mom that she had to travel to Mauritius because Mauritius was the only link to Chagos. And when my mom and dad decided to have treatment, we all traveled to Mauritius, but in a view to return because all our belongings we have left on Peros Banos, just after my sister treatment, we will return back. And fortunately, arriving in Mauritius, 3 months after my sister passed away, when my mom and dad decided to return, and at that time we learned that it will be impossible for us because the island had been given to America to build a U.S. military base. We were obliged to live in Mauritius.
Philippe, Olivier's story is completely shocking, especially that it was done only a few decades ago. How many people had this done to them?
It's totally shocking. This was done in 67, 68, and you know, quite a large number of people. Then for the people who had not gone to Mauritius or elsewhere, I mean, I can tell you the story of Lisby Elize. She was born in 1953. She lives on Peros Banos. She described how on a single day, they were rounded up in the evening and told they would be leaving early the next morning before daybreak. And about 400 people on the 29th of April 1973 were put on board a boat, and they weren't told why they were leaving. They weren't told that they couldn't come back. They weren't told where they were going, and they were kept in the hold of the vessel, and 4 days later they arrived in Mauritius.
What about their stuff, their photo albums, their possessions, their pets? What happened to all of that?
They were allowed one wooden chest They were told whatever they could pack into that wooden chest would be put on the boat. Everything else had to be left behind. And one aspect that they were pretty upset about was that they were not allowed to take any pets. They have a lot of pet dogs. The dogs were all rounded up. The British first tried to poison them with strychnine. That didn't work. And they were then gassed.
Oh, my God. They killed the dogs?
They killed all the dogs, yeah, all the dogs. If you talk with them, the most traumatic aspects of it, the killing of the dogs is pretty much top of the list.
I can't quite believe these people, these communities that had lived on the island for generations, were treated basically like property to be moved to a more convenient place. How was all of this seen in the UK?
Basically, no one knew about it. None of this went through any act of parliament. It was never debated. It was all done by secret orders in council. By 1973, I was 12, 13 years old. I was studying history at school. I knew nothing about the Chagos Archipelago. I then went and studied law. I did international law. And really, it was only in 2010 when I was hired by the Prime Minister of Mauritius to look at the legal options that I started focusing it. And I was pretty shocked, frankly, by my own ignorance. Some of the things that emerged in that litigation was pretty shocking, not least the internal British memoranda from the 1960s when they were working out what to do with the Chagossians, and some very unfortunate material referring to the Chagossians on the Chagos Archipelago as Tarzans or Man Fridays. Get l'horizon, fait coco pesa couillé, ça fait moi ma zine, mon pays.
And where the Chagossian communities were resettled, how did they fare? I mean, how were they able to settle and try to rebuild themselves?
Well, they fared with great difficulties.
The Chagossians here in the UK have spent years trying and failing to get the right to return to what they call their rightful home.
They are forcibly deported to Mauritius and to Seychelles, and some make their way to the United Kingdom, basically dumped at Gatwick Airport, and they establish a small community at the local town nearest to Gatwick Airport, which is called Crawley.
As a second-generation Chagos Islander, she's a British Overseas Territory citizen, but that doesn't pass automatically to her children.
In relation to those who were forcibly deported from Peros Banios, the island that I know the best, they took 4 days to get to Mauritius, the capital, Port Louis. They arrived. There was no one to meet them. They had no money. They had nowhere to live. And they were basically left on their own.
We left a paradise. We were dumped in Mauritius. We were left in a slum of Mauritius. There was no support mechanism. The British did not look after us.
Then in the 1980s, they did receive little driblets of compensation via the British. And with those, they built themselves homes. I've seen their homes. But I think life was incredibly tough.
It was a shock for my family to face this kind of life, facing with problems like drugs, alcohol and prostitution, even jobless and bad education.
Where did your family go? I mean, where did they end up when they left? Did they stay in Mauritius?
We stayed in Mauritius for many years. It was very difficult. You know, the type of life that we had in Peros Banos and Salomon in Chagos is very different.
I remember my father got a stroke, and suddenly my mom had to work in 5 different places in order to feed the family.
In Chagos, everyone has his own house. We have a job. But arriving in Mauritius, it was very difficult for us, first of all, to adapt ourselves and to find a house to rent and to have a job. But we were obliged to find out a way.
Olivier said the move was very difficult, but that's kind of an understatement. I learned after we talked that he lost 3 brothers and a sister to drug abuse, alcohol and suicide. Part of a generation of Chagossians who didn't survive what had been done to them. While families like Olivier's struggled to rebuild their lives, back in Chagos, new people were arriving. The biggest island, Diego Garcia, was being transformed.
Well, Diego Garcia had started as a military base really in 1973. Ironically, its first name was Camp Justice.
Diego Garcia is owned by the British, but home to the U.S. Navy and Air Force. The island has everything from swimming pools to basketball courts to even a four-lane bowling alley, but it's set up for serious business.
It was essentially supposed to begin as a naval facility to resupply, but over time they built a landing strip, and it's now the home to B-1 and B-52 bombers.
The base played a major role during the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and planes there have been used in Afghanistan.
Now, and, of course, Diego Garcia was a black site used in the program to render detainees, al-Qaeda, and other characters around the world. Often the stopping-off point, it seems, was Diego Garcia. So it's now a pretty significant U.S. military base.
Olivier, when you were a boy, did you think about the Chagos Islands? Like, did you ever think that you want to return one day, that that was your real home?
I just want to know more about where I was born. After my secondary study, my mom had just encouraged me. She said, you know, you have education, you need to stand up for your people. This is how I've become involved. And since at the age of 19, I started to be involved in the struggle. And now I'm proud to lead the main organization, which is Chagos Refugees Group, fighting for the fundamental rights of our people.
From a tiny lockup in the poorest section of Port Louis, Mauritius, Olivier Bancor, an electrician, has taken the struggle across the world.
And tell me about that struggle. How have you been fighting to try to get back home?
First of all, in 1997, I started legal procedure against the British government. First of all, to challenge the British Ordinance 1971, who precludes the right of return. By challenging this law, I won my first historical judgment on 3rd November 2000.
Give us back our
island!
Give us back our
island!
Diego!
Russia!
Diego!
Russia!
They're a very, very small community, and they've been pretty remarkable. Olivier Bancour, he has been litigating in the English courts. He actually got a positive judgment in 2000, and the then Labour government changed policy and decided that they would allow them to go back. But then Iraq happened and the war on terror, and the Labour government, Tony Blair and Jack Straw, changed direction, and that was extinguished.
After a ban on returning was upheld by the UK Supreme Court this year, campaigners pinned their hopes on a government review. Now Britain says it will instead pay them around $50 million over 10 years.
And all the litigation since then has not been successful in changing their legal situation.
We do not consider that the right of self-determination actually applies to the Chagossians. In fact, the issue here is one of sustainability and viability.
Then what has happened in parallel is the government of Mauritius has taken up the cause of who owns the islands and the cause of the question of the return of the Chagossians.
A humiliating defeat for the UK and its ally, the US, in the UN General Assembly.
And there have been three international cases. In 2015, an arbitral tribunal ruled that the British efforts to conserve the marine environment were illegal. In 2019, the International Court of Justice said decolonization was not complete. And in 2021, the Tribunal for the Law of the Sea ruled decisively and in a binding judgment that Mauritius is the coastal state. And in the midst of all of that, the UN General Assembly passed a resolution which got overwhelming support in May 2019, which said two things. First, Chagos belongs to Mauritius, it's part of its territory. And second, the Chagossians have the right to return. And there was a third thing too, the UK must leave by November 2019.
The Mauritian Prime Minister has called the United Kingdom an illegal colonial occupier after it ignored a UN deadline to hand back the Chagos Islands.
The British government concocted in the early 2000s the idea of bringing the Chagossians back to visit their homeland, to tidy up the graves, and those were given the dreadful title of heritage visits.
Olivier, you've been part of one of those heritage visits. What was that like?
Always a visit had been done by UK government, but escorted by policemen. Everywhere where we move, there is always policemen who just look out for us, all our action.
I mean, how did that feel for you to be in the place where your family had been removed from, but with a policeman watching you?
Oh, it's something very, very embarrassing because they consider that you commit an offense, whereas you never committed. It's something just to return to your roots and especially the place where we were born, and to be accompanied by someone you look like something, which is not good, you see?
Were the police friendly with you, or were they a little bit hostile?
No, unfortunately, their behavior was not good. They just said that we have only 2 or 3 hours to spend on the island, and we had to go. Frankly, it is very shameful to behave like that.
So that was the first time you'd been to your home on the island since you were just a little kid, and you were only allowed there for a couple of hours. What had happened to the house where you grew up?
Everything had been demolished because it was built by a small hut, coconut tree. If you don't maintain a house like that, of course, it will demolish.
One of the ways of looking at this is asking yourself the question, what is the difference between the community that lives in the Falkland Islands, Malvinas, and the community that lives or lived in Chagos Archipelago? They're both about 2,000 in number. There is only one difference, and that is the color of the people's skin.
Frankly, I think because they are white people and they have blue eyes, whereas we came from African origin. We are coming from slaves. This is why we got this kind of treatment. And it's very, 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 very sad. The way of treatment that the UK government gave to the Sagosian people. We're still suffering and still continue to let our people suffering and still continue to deny our fundamental right to live as all human beings on his birthplace.
So, after a half century of struggle and a 5-day sea journey, this past Saturday,
a boat has arrived in the disputed Chagos archipelago in the Indian Ocean.
This is a hugely significant moment in the tug of war between Britain and Mauritius over ownership of the...
It fell to Olivier to put the feelings of the Chagos Islanders into words.
Welcome everyone in our birthplace, where I, Marcel and Lisby was born. Really, it was a paradise, where people live in peace and harmony. This trip is so important.
As he spoke, he was watched by journalists, Mauritian government officials, and scientists. But this time, no soldiers, no policemen.
If we are here, we are not coming as tourists, no. We are coming in a pilgrim, especially to pay tribute. There, all this abandoned place, where we have our brothers, our sisters, our grandparents, our parents buried there, who had been abandoned for so many years. But
if you look, the 5 Chagosians, the first of their people to freely return, kneeled, kissed the sand, said a prayer. Before they left, the Mauritian flag was raised above the land that's still, officially, British Indian Ocean territory.
But no one can know our sufferings more than we. No one can know our sufferings more than what we have been passed. The forcible remove, as a deportation, the forcible exile. Everything that we have been faced, a just cause. We are not asking more. We are not asking less. We are asking our right as human beings. Thank you, my brothers and sisters.
Coming up, after Saturday's historic landing, what's the future of the Chagosian struggle to go home? Philippe, you're representing the faction of Chagosians who do want these islands returned to Mauritian control. And it's important to say that that isn't the view of all Chagos Islanders. There are some who disagree with that strategy, but they all agree that they want to return. And I want to know, is there any precedent for that, for people who were forcibly cleared from their land decades later to try and make a comeback and successfully do it?
I'm not aware of any case which has gone to international law in this way, in which the right of return has been at the heart, and in which, if you like, a precedent has been set in the context of decolonization. And that characterizes this particular story, makes it special. That a community that has been removed is allowed to go back, even on a visit like we're making now. So I think it's a very significant historic case. There's another reason that it's historic. The Chagos Archipelago is Britain's last colony in Africa, or was Britain's last colony in Africa. It's still occupying it illegally. So this is really sunset on empire, at least on the African part of the British Empire. And I think that makes it a very historic case.
The kind of work of British decolonization is ongoing, and its next front line is the Chagos Islands.
Well, I think we're almost there, not just in terms of this journey on a boat, but in terms of encouraging, shall we say, the British government of today to recognise the game is up. We're actually beginning to see, we think, the first signs of recognition that their position is untenable. It really is only a question of time. It's not whether the UK recognises its time is up, but when.
Olivier, so many Chagosians who were forced from their lands have died. You're in your 50s now, and nearly all of your life has taken place off the islands. Have you ever, in this long struggle, thought to yourself, too much time has passed, maybe we need to just move on?
Not never, never too late, my friend, never too late, because, you know, everyone in this world would like to know about where they come from. Everyone in this world wants to know about their roots. Why not Chagosian? Why not Chagosian?
Do you believe that one day you'll live again in Paros Banos? Like, can you imagine it happening?
Of course. It's my dream, because not only me, I just want my children to know. Not only my children, but all the children of the Chagosian community.
One of the reasons the British government gives for not allowing you to go back is that they say the island is uninhabitable, that it's not possible to live there anymore. And all the adult Chagosians who did once live there are now very old. What do you say to that?
We have a plan. We have a project. We need to build houses with all facilities, utilities important that need to be used for a human being. We know that it could take time, but we are very excited to continue to plan to make things prepare for our future.
That was Olivier Bankou, a Chagos Islander who's part of the delegation of his people who went home unsupervised for the first time this past weekend. Thanks so much to him for speaking with us, and also to Philippe Sands, an international lawyer representing the Mauritian government. You can read all our coverage of the homecoming of the Chagosian people at theguardian.com. That's it for today.
You're listening to Amanda here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, Quebec, Canada, and around the world on CKUT.ca.
When the Omicron crisis was first brought to public attention by scientists in South Africa, and the world reaction in response to its virulence and fast-spreading nature was to shut down South Africa, the borders to South Africa and travel to and from South Africa and 9 other countries, including our dear old Malawi. Yeah. And the Omicron really has knocked us for a loop. It is, I guess it's about the 4th wave. I've stopped counting, but there has been a lot learned, and where so many predictions of dire outcomes for Africa at the very beginning of COVID came about. There are lessons learned, and the conversation is a wonderful go-to source for information. They did a podcast on the lessons learned by South Africa from the Omicron crisis. So listen to it, and we'll learn a lot.
Hello, and welcome to The Conversation Weekly.
This week, 2 South African scientists tell us the story of Omicron's discovery and what lessons their experience can give the rest of the world about future COVID-19 variants.
Now learned over a course of 4 waves that you cannot prevent the dissemination of a variant by restricting travel to and from a handful of countries. It doesn't work.
Hopefully countries going forward will not stigmatize other countries that are identifying variants of concern.
I'm Gemma Ware in London.
And I'm Dan Marino in San Francisco. You're listening to The Conversation Weekly, The World Explained by Experts.
We're joined this week by Ozir Patel, digital editor for The Conversation in South Africa. Hey, Oz.
Hey, how's it going, Oz?
Hey, Gemma. Hey, Dan.
Oz, you're in Johannesburg. Tell us, what's the COVID situation like where you are right now?
Okay, so South Africa is on alert level one. This means that most of the restrictions are eased. There are gatherings allowed, no more than 1,000 people indoors and no more than 2,000 people outdoors. Curfews have been lifted, but people are still required to wear masks in public places and to sanitize frequently.
And how many daily cases are there?
So well over the peak, the end of January had numbers in the 2 and 3,000s, and about 1 in 10 tests came back positive.
And what did case numbers and test positivity look like a few weeks ago during the Omicron surge?
So in the peak around December, it reached about 37,000 cases, which is about one in every third person who has testing. And around that time, daily cases were regularly in the 20,000s. The numbers are much more manageable now, and hospitals aren't overburdened.
So it was South African scientists who first alerted the world to Omicron. And in this episode, you and Gemma have been talking to a couple of them about what those first few weeks were like. And I think about some of the really important lessons their experience can provide to the rest of the world.
Yep, that's right. So the first person we spoke to was Janelle Beeman. She's a medical scientist at South Africa's National Institute for Communicable Diseases, which is the National Public Health Institute.
When did you first hear about a new variant of coronavirus?
So in the first or second week of November, right, Lancet Laboratories, which is a private testing laboratory here in South Africa, contacted the NICD and they said, listen, guys, we're seeing something strange. And what they were seeing was this S gene target failure. So an S gene target failure is basically where you have the S gene for coronavirus not being detected. And usually when you have a PCR test being done, there are three genes that are tested, right? S gene would be one of them. And we usually see all three genes coming up positive. The exception was with the alpha variant. It was also characterized by this S gene target failure. And in South Africa, we didn't really see high numbers or high frequencies of the alpha variant circulating. So when Lancet started seeing that, it was really quite a rapid increase in the frequency of this S gene target failure within 2 weeks. They were quite concerned. So Lancet Laboratories, in addition to doing PCR testing, they can also do sequencing. So Lancet agreed to select a couple of these S gene target failures, just eight of them, that were from all different districts within one of our provinces, within the Gauteng province, where we first saw this S gene target failure. They were from different age groups, different areas, geographic areas within this province. And then they send the raw results basically to us for analysis. And so at 9 o'clock on Friday, the 19th of November, in the evening, our Lancet colleague Raquel, she sent us these raw reads, 9 o'clock in the evening.
And what was it like when you first saw those raw results?
There's four of us on this team who kind of routinely look at our sequence data. It's myself, Catherine, Daniel, and Josie. So this result came back, and literally every single one of these eight specimens had these crazy number of mutations. And so we hadn't seen this many mutations. So our first thought was, there's something wrong. We need to redo the analysis. It's kind of like an inherent scientific trait. You always criticize anything you see. So Friday night, we reran the analysis overnight. Saturday morning, the analysis came out and it had failed. No result. Already we were like, there's something weird. There's something funky. So that was Josie. She ran the analysis on Friday night. Then Daniel said, no, let him do it. He's going to rerun the analysis on Saturday. Sunday morning, the analysis came out, it had failed again. So Daniel decided, okay, let's try a completely different pipeline. So on Monday morning, we got the result on a different pipeline, and this time it had worked, and it was exactly what we had seen that Friday night. All these mutations were confirmed to be real, and yeah.
What did you then do? The four of you then?
So once we confirmed everything, we wanted to just get a couple more samples and make sure that it was real. We also wanted to get a couple more sequences, like from our own kind of surveillance and diagnostic where we'd seen S-gene target failures. We also then got into contact with the rest of our consortium within the Network for Genomic Surveillance in South Africa. We told them about these mutations. They also, you know, tried to reach out to all the various testing labs that make our consortium work. And we just tried to bulk up the numbers, just try to get more and more samples so that we could confirm this was real and this was happening. And obviously, the diagnostic labs then got involved and they started analyzing their data and started seeing across the board that there was this rapid increase in the S-gene target failures. So we took about a week to confirm everything and make sure that, you know, we weren't jumping to conclusions or anything.
And what did you do with the data next?
The following week was when we shared the data with our government. We uploaded it to GISAID, this public repository for SARS-CoV-2 genomes. One of the checks that we do when we see something unusual is we check GISAID. Has anybody else seen this? You know, we were checking every single day. We were not seeing anything. We uploaded our sequences on Monday morning. So literally, we submitted our presentation to our minister. It said, there's no other sequences on GISAID. You know, these are the only ones. And then a couple hours later, when we checked again, you know, there were the sequences from both Botswana and Hong Kong.
What happened next?
Our government made a formal announcement that Thursday after we informed them. And yes, things exploded from that week on in terms of travel bans, in terms of scientists trying to do as much as quickly as possible. So by the second week, we had sequenced over 200 samples from across South Africa, all different provinces. I think at that point, we had confirmed it in four of our nine provinces. But what was more striking was the diagnostic lab results. So even though we didn't have sequencing results from every single province, the diagnostic labs were reporting this increase in S-gene target failure in every province. And it was rapid and it was drastic. What we also started seeing was that there was this increase in the reinfection risk, regardless of whether the person was vaccinated or not. And so I think we had an emergency WHO viral evolution working group meeting. I think it was on the Friday after our government announced the variant. And that was when it was declared a variant of concern. And I think rightly so.
You just heard from the World Health Organization. They are now classifying this new variant as a variant of concern, and they've given it a name, Omicron.
Tell me personally what it's been like for you as one of the scientists involved in that first kind of discovery of Omicron. There were the travel bans and it was quite a difficult moment for South Africa. What's happened to you and how have you felt about it?
So when we first, you know, obviously found this thing and confirmed it, I felt proud. To be fair, you know, I felt proud that we are doing our job and we're doing it well and we're getting this news out. In the very immediate days after our government made this announcement, quite a few of us on the consortium received death threats. And that was really scary. That was really scary because I have a little kid who stays at home alone with a nanny every day. And they basically, you know, they singled some of us out by name and it was... That was scary. Like, that made me question, should I be even doing this kind of thing? But it also made me really upset when all the international travel bans were imposed because they were irrational, you know? And I think now if you actually go and look at the retrospective data, Omicron was across the world.
Mm. So it must have been really scary. And why were people targeting scientists like you? And what's happened since? Has it calmed down?
Yeah, thankfully, it has calmed down. People were targeting scientists because of the travel bans. You know, South Africa is already in such a precarious economic situation since the start of this pandemic. It's impacted our country quite drastically. And so people were angry because there's now even further economic losses, you know. And basically, they felt that scientists shouldn't be raising the alarm. Like, this is not benefiting us in any way. And in any case, there's nothing we can do. So why are you telling the whole world about this? That was the reason people were so upset and so angry. And I feel them, and I completely understand it. It's just not fun being on the receiving side of that.
Tonight, drastic measures to contain the Omicron variant.
Has reported Israel, which is a record number of new coronavirus
cases. News of a new COVID-19 variant is creating panic all over the world.
Close its border.
A number of governments have now suspended travel from the...
As Omicron cases were reported in more and more countries, labs in South Africa and Sweden were quickly trying to find out how all its mutations would affect our body's immune response, what's called neutralization resistance. They wanted to know how well antibodies induced by the vaccine or by a prior COVID infection would protect people against getting infected with Omicron. There were other questions too about whether the variant was more transmissible, and about how T cells would respond to an infection. Now, T cells are a core part of our body's immune system. They work alongside, but in a different way, to B cells, which create antibodies. As a little aside here, Janelle told us a really good analogy to help understand all this.
So the B cell arm, if you think about a wall, it's kind of like the archers standing on the brink of the castle, and they're shooting down the invaders before they have a chance to get in. And then the T cell arm, they actually perform the job of killing the invaders once they're inside the castle. They're cells, T cells, that actually go and kill other cells that are infected with virus.
So while the antibodies help prevent infection, it's the T cells which help prevent severe disease and hospitalization. Another scientist in South Africa looking closely at the data on all this was Shabir Mahdi. He's a professor of vaccinology at the University of Witwatersrand and a dean of the Faculty of Health Sciences there. He's been working on vaccine research for nearly three decades and also led two of the COVID-19 vaccine trials conducted in South Africa. The conversation has been talking to him a lot during the pandemic to help explain what's been happening. And Oz and I called him up again to talk about Omicron. Now, Shabi is based at a hospital in Soweto, a busy township in the south of Johannesburg. And apologies, but you may hear a bit of traffic noise in the background. What was your first reaction when those scientists called you at the end of November and you saw the sequencing?
Well, I was fairly optimistic still. I was much more optimistic than the guys that were doing the sequencing as to what this meant. They feared that this variant was also going to be able to evade T-cell immunity. And I was skeptical about that, just leveraging on the experience that I had almost a year before with the AstraZeneca vaccine, where the beta variant pretty much evaded antibody induced by the AstraZeneca vaccine, but subsequently the same vaccine was shown to protect against severe disease due to the beta variant. So despite the scientists sounding a more pessimistic note, I was still fairly comfortable that we were not going to experience what we had experienced during the course of the Delta variant wave in relation to large number of severe disease cases and death, and that we would be much better off this time around, despite the antibody evasiveness.
And what were the next few weeks for you like? You know, what were you doing in November, December, in those kind of early stages when Omicron was spreading?
So we obviously have been involved in a number of studies throughout this period of time. And then in addition to that, it was really about engaging with the public and with the scientific community in terms of understanding exactly what is it that we're facing and what can we expect moving forward. And just keeping an eye on the data that was started to flow in very quickly from a number of places, which clearly demonstrated that this variant was far more transmissible than anything that we experienced in the past. But already 2 to 3 weeks into this wave, we started to then already post on social media and start engaging with the media, saying that there's something very different where we are seeing this decoupling of infections relative to hospitalization and death. The death rate was subdued. So I started to call physicians in the public sector as well as the private sector, asking them, what are you experiencing? Because there's this world sort of panic around Omicron. Everyone is shutting their borders to South Africa, which was another issue that we needed to tackle in terms of calling countries to account for why they were embarking on a strategy, which largely would be futile. But I think the interaction with the physicians on the ground was very informative in that they were telling me clearly that our ICUs are empty. In fact, the majority of infections that are occurring in the hospitals at the time of the peak of the Omicron wave were not people being admitted for COVID-19,
but rather incidental infections. Because the practice in the public as well as the private hospitals in South Africa is every individual that was being admitted to a hospital is tested, irrespective of symptomatology. And at the hospital where my research unit is based, in fact, the majority of cases that were being identified were pregnant women that were delivering babies. There's about 60 women that were delivering babies per day, of whom 30, 40% of them were testing positive for the virus.
This isn't the first time that South African scientists have identified a variant of concern.
South Africa is experiencing a rise in COVID-19 cases. This comes as a new variant of the coronavirus has been detected.
In December 2020, the World Health Organization labeled a new variant, first discovered in South Africa, as a variant of concern that later became known as Beta. At that time, the first COVID-19 vaccines were only just getting approval worldwide, and in South Africa, there was limited immunity from the first wave of infection. As cases rose and pressure on hospitals mounted, restrictions were tightened. But when the Omicron wave arrived, the South African government's reaction was different. A curfew, in place in various forms since March 2020, remained, but no new restrictions were introduced.
The National Coronavirus Command Council has decided to retain South Africa at adjusted level one of COVID-19 pandemic lockdown.
And then in the last days of 2021, the curfew was lifted.
The government has lifted the curfew and there are now no restrictions on the movement of people.
How do you think South African government has dealt with Omicron? What do you think it got right? What do you think it got wrong?
What they got right this time around was not to reflexively go to a higher level of restrictions as soon as they saw a surge in number of cases and as soon as scientists sounded a warning of a new variant. They had a much more nuanced approach in that they were planning on focusing on hospitalization and death. So that is something that really worked in our favor because we sort of avoided doing further harm to the economy, to the livelihoods of people, just to the mental well-being of people. And that much more nuanced approach worked extremely well in South Africa. What did we get wrong? Unfortunately, government didn't take some advice with regard to ensuring that we got adequate immunization vaccine coverage, particularly of the high-risk group. We could have done much better. Rather than just trying to chase after numbers of people that were vaccinated, and even up until now, government still hasn't got this right, is that it needs to focus on getting 90% of people above the age of 50 vaccinated rather than going for some arbitrary target of 70% of the population. The other thing they completely miscalculated is delaying the booster dose of vaccine to those people above the age of 50 that have already received one or two doses of vaccine. They created a whole lot of hurdles requiring people to come with a doctor's certificate before they would be eligible for a booster dose.
So, Prof. Mari, what's the situation in South Africa now?
Yeah, so we very much at the tail end of the Omicron wave. It does differ across the provinces. In the Gauteng province, the positivity rate, which is a good metric as to the amount of virus that's likely circulating, is less than 5%. Nationally, that has come down to 8%. At the time of the peak of the Omicron wave, our positivity rate was around about 39%. So we can start making some definitive conclusions, and more so for Gauteng province. And what we experience in Gauteng is that when we look at all of the number of people that have died of COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic, the Omicron wave contributes to less than 5% of all COVID-19 deaths since the start of the pandemic. The Delta variant wave contributed to 50%. So we've seen a complete decoupling. And again, the same thing goes for hospitalization. The hospitalization rate for people that were testing positive, and this includes incidental infections, for the Omicron wave is about one-third compared to the hospitalization rate for the Delta variant wave. So we've just seen a dramatic decoupling of infections, hospitalization, and death. Death have occurred, unfortunately, but we're sort of going into a period of this pandemic which I term as the convalescent period. And to some extent, my estimate is that the number of people that would have died during the course of the Omicron wave is going to be less than the number of people that typically would have died during the course of a seasonal influenza in South Africa, which was around about 10 to 11,000 before COVID.
So do you think Omicron has made it easier for the world to live with the virus?
Well, I think after the waves have subsided in the countries, countries will reflect in terms with regard to the experience. And I think many countries will start recalibrating at long last. And the UK pretty much has now decided that COVID-19 is something they're going to live with. And I believe many other countries, after this wave has passed, will start coming to the same sort of conclusion, that it's no longer about preventing infections. Yes, there is consequences to infections, including long COVID, but unfortunately, the consequences of the type of restrictions we've imposed in society, the economic consequences, the impact of livelihoods, the impact on children in terms of their education, the mental well-being of citizens, doesn't lend itself to a prolongation of the type of restrictions that we've indulged in over the past 2 years. And also with a high percentage of the population being infected with Omicron, I do believe that is going to serve as a boost to immunity that has already arisen from infections, as well as a boost to immunity that has arisen through vaccines. So there's generally a preservation of the T-cell responses that's induced both by vaccines as well as natural infection, even when you've got a variant such as Omicron, which has got extensive mutations that makes a variant antibody evasive. So I do believe that with Omicron being so transmissible, that people will be even more protected against severe disease and possibly even against infections in the next few months.
Omicron will not be the last coronavirus variant. Others have emerged since, causing flashes of alarm. But so far, none of them have been labelled a variant of concern by the WHO. But how much do we actually know about the way new variants like Omicron emerge? Oz put this question to Janelle Beeman.
What do we know, what don't we know about where Omicron came from?
So there are three hypotheses for where this virus came from. And there is not good enough evidence to support anyone. So the first theory, which I think was propagated quite a lot initially, was that because there's so many mutations in Omicron, it could have arisen in somebody who had prolonged infection. And because this person has like more than 2 weeks infection with the virus, you have a situation, it's a closed environment basically, where you have a cat and mouse between that person's antibody response and the virus. And that is what drives the selection of more and more mutations. And because it was South Africa, a lot of people were saying this arose in somebody who was HIV positive, who had prolonged infection. Because we do know that quite a number of HIV positive people have these prolonged infections because their immune systems are not optimal, obviously. The second theory is that this virus did a loop and went back into some kind of animal species and has been replicating and being transmitted within this animal species and mutating over time and then spilled back into humans. So that's the second one. And then the third theory is that it's been mutating slowly. I mean, this virus has been with us for over 2 years now, and it's been mutating in the background. And because we don't sequence every single person that's infected, we don't even know of every single person that's infected because there are so many asymptomatic infections, that this has been mutating in the background and we just haven't picked it up because it hasn't infected a large number of people. And maybe it hasn't been transmissible until it acquired one or two mutations that allowed it to explode.
How important is it to understand the origins of variants, to understand the future trajectory of COVID-19?
If we identify the origin of a variant, whether we can practically, you know, find solutions to prevent this from happening, I don't know that that's reasonable to even think about. But I think, for example, if we conclusively say that HIV-infected individuals who are immunocompromised are causing for selection of these kinds of variants, then it certainly provides stronger evidence and stronger motivation for us to get back to our HIV programs, to make sure that we're trying to get as many people onto ARVs and virologically suppressed as possible and return the focus to kind of pre-pandemic issues that are still prevailing.
Another variant could spring up anywhere in the world at any time. But which scientists detect it and where will ultimately depend on a country's sequencing and testing capacity.
Why do you think the lesson South Africa's experience with Omicron can provide for the rest of the world and the discovery of other variants in the future?
So I think there was a huge amount of skepticism as late as 2 to 3 weeks ago with regard to the South African experience and what we were showcasing, where we're saying there was this huge decoupling of infection, severe disease and death. And much of that was coming from the north because they felt that, well, the Northern Hemisphere countries are very different from South Africa in terms of the demographic, which is true. But at the same time, that seems to be oblivious to the reality and to the data. South Africa does not have this phenomenally healthy population. In fact, we've got an unhealthier population, despite the younger population, than many high-income countries. And we have been disproportionately affected during the course of the first three waves. So there seemed to be a reluctance to accept that the data that we're showing and the optimism that we were expressing was something that was real, until they started to all of a sudden report it from the U.S., and Anthony Fauci indicated we're seeing this decoupling and we should focus on hospitalization and death. And then the UK came out and said, well, we're also seeing this decoupling. And all of a sudden, it's become the mantra that there is this decoupling. Well, we did say it about a month ago. And we need to ask, why was that information? And I do believe it was scientists, high-income country governments were very dismissive and didn't really apply their minds in terms of the experience that was coming out from South Africa.
Recently, in an interview with BBC, you expressed that you thought Western skepticism of the analysis coming out of South Africa was racist. Can you tell us why? What led you to say this? Yeah.
So I need to correct it. I didn't say that it was racist. In fact, I was asked by the person that was interviewing me whether it's racism, and I said it might be, but I don't think it's racism. I think, especially as a South African, we're extremely sensitive to the use of the term racism. What I do believe it is cultural imperialism, which is different. And cultural imperialism has got an element of superiority, superiority of thought and superiority that we know best. But again, when people express concern that your experience is going to be different in our country that has got 90% vaccine coverage, for me, that is difficult to comprehend because it undermines the case for vaccination. And especially when we're saying that the primary goal of vaccines is to protect against severe disease and death. And then all of a sudden to make a U-turn and say, well, we can't really say whether these vaccines are going to protect against severe disease and death due to Omicron, knowing that vaccines induce a substantial amount of other responses than just antibody responses, which are less affected by the mutations that have occurred. And the models are already predicting that the T-cell immunity that was going to be induced by vaccines, the past infection, were going to be relatively conserved, despite the mutations that occurred in Omicron. I mean, I think those scientists and governments need to explain themselves. But I do believe it's a manifestation of cultural imperialism, where we will not believe anyone else unless we show the same first.
How can other countries prepare themselves if they discover a variant in their geography in the future, and learning from South Africa's experience, what should they be focusing on?
Well, to avoid the type of reaction that was inflicted on South Africa, just don't share your data. That's the safest thing to do. And obviously, that's the most reckless thing to do and the most unscientific thing to do. And I think the global community needs to make a stance that when countries start reporting data, they're not going to be penalized for it, which is pretty much what happened to South Africa. South Africa were penalized for being forthcoming with the data. And that's an incorrect approach. And we've now learned over the course of four waves that you cannot prevent the dissemination of a variant by restricting travel to and from a handful of countries. It doesn't work.
That wraps it up for us here on Amanla this week. Thank you, Doug, for putting that all together for us. We will be back next week. But in the meantime, stay tuned for Jazz Euphoria.
Tune in to CKUT 90.3 FM. Tuesdays, 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. for a special Black History Month edition of the Montreal Sessions. The month kicks off on February 1st with the best in reggae and soca with your hosts, Production Sounds and Soca Head. Week 2, February 8th, Wizzy Moonchaser, host of The Morning Detour, broadcast live from DG Kicks, a sneaker store in NDG. Final 2 weeks, 15th and 22nd, are hosted by Stephen Ziplocks Hennessy, educator, creator, and part of the Ill Groove Garden team. Don't miss it.
Africa unite, Batsilelile. Africa unite, Batsilelile.
This is Tony from Planet Giza, and you're listening to CKUT Montreal Community Radio. This is the crib right here, so shout-outs to every station on here, and shout-outs to you, the listener. Don't go nowhere. We'll be right back.
If it appears that COVID-19 symptoms like cough, fever, sore throat, and loss of taste and smell are beginning to present themselves, you can begin to self-isolate and take a rapid test at home. After getting your test results, you can learn more about proper self-isolation guidelines by visiting quebec.ca/self-isolating. This information is there to help protect you and everyone living under the same roof. All of us can make a difference, so let's keep making sure all of us are safe. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Where's the beat?